This is Dave Vellante. I got about two before the hour. We usually get started about two past. So this is the February 3rd Wikibon Peer Insight on Managing, Archiving, and Retention Risk. Okay, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining this, the 55th Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting. This is Dave Vellante, and I'll be your host today, moderating the call. So as you heard me say earlier, the topic is Managing, Archiving, and Retention Risk. And our guest is Michael McCreary, who is a VP at Rational Retention, which is a New York-based startup. Many of you may know Mike from his days at Pfizer, where, in addition to a number of other IT roles, he was the head of Pfizer's legal IT operation and was responsible for the technology infrastructure related to email archiving, e-discovery, and the like. Welcome, Michael.
Welcome.
So, Gary McFadden, are you on the call?
I am.
Gary is the champion of Wikibon's recently launched information management portal, which you can see on the website at wikibon.org under the portal links. Gary and I were down at Legal Tech yesterday, as was Michael, who was still there, so we can share some of what we saw there if we have time. As most of you know, the Wikibon Peer Insight is a bi-monthly conference call. We talk about how technologies align and support the development of user business capabilities. I would like to ask that if you're not speaking, please mute your line, and if you want to speak, please unmute. If you don't have a mute button, a hands-free mute, you can hit 4-star to mute and then 4-star to unmute if you want to participate. Everybody, by the way, is welcome to participate. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your experiences. This call is being recorded and it's going to last 1 hour. So let me set up the basic premise for the call, and then I'll turn it over to Mike. So we all know that unstructured data is creating an exposure in general and specifically with regard to emails, and we're all familiar with the changes to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure about 2 years ago. So those things combined with aggressive technology marketing and legal departments' concern over getting sued has led to an archive everything and keep it forever mentality, which brings a set of challenges for users, including cost, complexity, performance problems, and very importantly, unforeseen risk of retaining information forever. And so the clients that we talk to are aware of this. They're demanding better solutions. The vendors in the marketplace are sensitized to it. So today what we'd like to do is just frame the problem a little bit more and talk about the emerging technologies that can address the issue and architectural approaches that users can consider going forward to mitigate that risk effectively, potentially with a less impact to the business. And then we'll talk about the business capability and the likely ROI impacts, both the cost and the benefits. So welcome again, Michael. First, did I set up the premise of the call correctly? And then if you want to add anything to that, go ahead. And then if you would, just flesh out the problem and the repercussions a bit.
Absolutely. So, yeah, Dave, I think you did set up the premise pretty nicely. Just to reiterate, I mean, as we all know, the explosion of data over the last 10 years has been remarkable. Importantly, the data that has really driven the growth has been the unstructured data. While the data that you see in your typical ERP system, that's been growing pretty rapidly to some extent compared to the data that exists in document management systems and file shares, all the loose, what we term loose files, has been really, really going through the roof over the last several years, and clearly causing some challenges for IT just in of itself from a volume perspective. That said, at the very same time, we've seen a big increase in regulations. So as Dave mentioned, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were changed in 2006, late in December of 2006, to require that electronically stored information be a component of any civil litigation. And that was adopted at the federal level and then is now broadly being adopted at the state level, and similar rules we're seeing being adopted internationally as well. Also, though, other regulations such as HIPAA, SOX compliance, there's a host of regulations that privacy, things like that, have been enacted and are hitting the organization all at the same time while the data is growing. So it's really created a pretty untenable situation for both the IT side and the legal side and the compliance folks. So we've seen, as Dave said, what we believe is a knee-jerk reaction. And by the way, I've done this myself. I'll speak a little bit to that later, which is archive everything. And really, it's one component of, in particular, the regulatory space that has driven this archive everything. And it's the requirement to preserve data. So what it means is, particularly in a litigation environment, you have a positive obligation to preserve any data, any information or files that could be implicated in a particular litigation. So that means virtually everything. Effectively, every file in your infrastructure, all petabytes, the entire, 3 petabytes of data you may have spinning out there, is all discoverable. And you have a positive obligation to preserve that information during a litigation. So where organizations have gone, as they said, okay, the only way that we can really effectively preserve that is to just archive it. Now, that's an approach that does, while it has merit and does work, it has massive implications. And those implications really are in 3 primary areas. It's certainly on storage costs. As a lot of people here are IT professionals who work in the storage space, and they recognize the massive increase in storage. Even though storage on a per unit basis has been going down, the amount of stuff that you've had to save has been going up at a faster rate, and it doesn't seem at present that that's going to necessarily level off. So we're seeing these archives are massive storage requirements, and they keep going up on a daily basis. Secondly, and this one's often missed, is that e-discovery, the act of associated with collecting data and providing it to the other party as part of litigation, the costs of e-discovery are going up dramatically as well. And a lot of people are missing this because IT is looking at it from one side and legal is looking at it from the other, and they're not getting together and really talking about the broader implications. And the reason the e-discovery costs are going up is e-discovery as an activity is primarily volume-driven. It ultimately gets down to any electronic discovery situation, ultimately gets down to a point. Hello? All right.
I'm sorry.
Everybody there?
Yep.
Okay, great. Any e-discovery situation ultimately gets down to a point where lawyers, who are pretty highly compensated, have to look at the documents. So the reality is that the more documents they look at, they're getting paid by the hour, and you can offshore it, and there's been all kinds of attempts at trying to bring down that cost. But nonetheless, you have people looking at documents. And when you have people effectively turning pages on tens of millions of documents, so litigations we're starting to see, there are litigations that are getting into the hundreds of millions of pages or half a billion pages. So you're having to have lawyers look at that. Those costs are incredible. So, again, storage is certainly one driver. E-discovery is another one. And then the other one, and it's a little more subtle, and it's more of a risk perspective, is, of course, having a bunch of documents around that can be used by a clever plaintiff's attorney, can be used against you. Even the organizations that are well behaved and playing by the rules, which we hope that everybody is, nonetheless, you can take a document that is 5 years or 8 or 10 years old, and it's effectively sterile. There's no context around it. The people who were involved in it at the time may not be available. It may have been just speculation. But they can. A really good plaintiff's attorney will take that document and will weave a story around that document and will weave basically their own reality around it. And again, that puts an organization at risk, no matter how. And if there is no legal obligation to retain that document and there is no business obligation to retain that document, there's no reason that it necessarily needs to be sitting around. So what you've got here are massive increases in costs and risk due to archiving everything. So I'm not sure how far we want to go. What we're starting to see is that you have a decentralized environment, but everybody's pushing, the vendors are out there in large part pushing the drive to put everything into that centralized archive. That's effectively the basic problem that's out there, and we're seeing it in a pretty consistent way. I can speak to some extent. While I was at Pfizer, I was responsible for putting in a very, very large email archive. And when we did that, we knew and had, I've done the calculations, what it was going to cost us. And we knew that what we were doing was a very tactical approach. And we also knew that in order to take it to the next level, we needed to have ways to segment that archive, to understand it by content, and then once we could understand it by content, we could then execute appropriate retention activities associated with that data. Do you want me to go? How far do you want me to go?
I think that's an excellent setup and a good starting point. Let me stop you there and see if anybody has anything they want to add to that problem definition before we flesh out the alternative solutions.
Yeah, Mike and Dave. David, how do you want to do the protocol for questions? Do we have to announce ourselves or just...
So what I'd like you to do is, at very least, if you could give us your first name or even a pseudonym, and then if you want, give us your full name. That's fine. And then just ask the question. Go ahead.
Sure. My name is Mike Versace. I'm doing some work on this currently. Another part of the problem that we've seen, at least in the financial services community, has been one around definition. Now, we've used the term unstructured information here, or unstructured content, unstructured electronically stored information. How much do you think of a problem we have? How much do you think the problem is associated with lack of formal definition of terms like unstructured content? What is a business record? What is an artifact? What is a transitory record? How much does that contribute to the problem that you just described?
That's a really good question. I think it contributes tremendously to it. Unstructured versus structured data is kind of informally described as things that it's either sitting at a database table or it's not, but there's certainly a number of things, you know, that are in between document management systems where metadata is in a table, but, you know, the file system is storing the actual physical document. So that's one component. And again, from a general risk perspective, it's those things that are unstructured. They tend to have the least control. But to take it to the next level, and I think where you went is an important one, is it really goes down to its record definition. So how are organizations going in and defining both the retention policy and the specific schedule? The schedule that says, I've got a legal obligation to keep this particular financial record, this particular HR record, this particular operational record for a specific period of time, and here's the laws associated with it. It's not a simple thing, and there isn't a simple answer for it. And certain organizations and certain people interpret what are a number of different rules associated with it in different ways. So you're absolutely right. Some of that segmentation, if you will, and definition of what is a record, what's not a record, and what needs to be kept and what doesn't need to be kept is pretty tricky. One of the ways that we often think about it is in kind of a pyramid that says at the very top are a set of records that there is a statutory legal obligation to keep, and they may only represent 5 or 10%, depending on the business, of the organization's files out there. The next level below that is information that the organization wants to keep around for, say, knowledge management. It's institutional knowledge, and it has value. But again, there is no statutory regulatory obligation to keep those, and that may represent, say, another 15 or 20%. Beyond that are a set of documents that are effectively works in progress that are things that you're working with on a daily basis to create, say, project documents and things like that. Their purpose and the volume of those and the retention on those should be kept around for as long as a project exists, and then after that they should be gotten rid of. And then the balance, effectively, is this huge set of, and use the term transitory, which a lot of people do use, are these transitory records that are effectively junk. They're not records, by the way, but they're transitory files that are effectively junk. And there's really no obligation from an organization perspective to keep it. However, the thing that really changes everything is the moment you've got a litigation, you have a positive obligation to preserve everything, regardless of what that is.
And we've seen that third piece being in assessments. I've seen assessments where maybe a third to 40% of the information stored is sort of unnecessary or junk, as you called it. Is that consistent with what other people are seeing?
I'll speak on my side, and then I'd be interested with others. I mean, as we've talked to really dozens of organizations in this case, we find that 20, 30, 40, 50% is easy. Many organizations would as they start to really look deep and they see all the stuff that's sitting on file shares that's 7, 8 years old, is it may be, you know, from a pure, you know, storage perspective, it may be 50, 60, 70%, which is a huge opportunity because they're keeping it around and getting no business value out of it. I'd be curious as what other folks, by the way, what their experience or belief is.
Is that consistent with what people are seeing?
Yes and no. Hi, David Berman. How are you?
Great.
Hi, Dave. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you, Dave. I'm working at a major financial institution, and what we've done is we've developed a taxonomy of all data that has been identified that is required to be archived, and it's defined retention period. So when you say that all data in a legal battle has to be archived, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think if you've defined a policy and you define the type of data and its policy, and as long as you continue and comply to that policy, I think you're covered. I mean, obviously you do have SOX compliance and regulatory compliance that you have to maintain, and within our taxonomy we've defined all that.
So actually what I said, and just to clarify, sorry about that.
Okay. No.
Is that is exactly what you just said, and that's the position we're taking, is that when I said litigation, the moment a litigation hits, it doesn't matter where it sits on your, whether it's a record or not, whether it's in your taxonomy or not, it doesn't matter. If you have a litigation and there's any chance that the document could be implicated in that litigation, it must be preserved. That's an absolute non-negotiable. That said, in the absence of litigation, there's absolutely no need to necessarily archive documents that, for you know, per your instance, that aren't part of your taxonomy, aren't part of your record structure, aren't part of a business value. There's no reason whatsoever to archive those at all. And in fact, archiving those is nothing but a waste of space, waste of energy, and frankly, it creates additional risk that doesn't need to be incurred.
Yeah, this is Gary McFadden with Wikibon. I just want to add that there are consultants out there that have done ROI and TCO studies that say that 20% of emails are unnecessary to even be written, and that the step you want to take even before you figure about how you build a defensibility strategy, or you build a taxonomy, or whether you're going to save or delete emails, is whether you're going to create them at all. And that many large corporations have gone through training where they've actually trained their employees on how to write emails and whether or not to create emails and whether or not to CC people, et cetera, whether they put them on PDFs, whether they put them on, PSTs within PSTs, whether they copy them onto their own on files and thumb drives, etc. So that's part of the front end process that people have to look at, as well as the behavior, is email behavior, and whether you want to create it at all.
Yes, absolutely. So we're seeing most organizations, particularly large organizations that are involved in litigation on a regular basis, being very proactive around education of the users of the broader population as to what they should be creating in the first place. That said, the reality is the email is arguably the single greatest productivity enhancer from a knowledge worker perspective that's ever come to play. So people are very wedded to it, and in fact, it's critical for an organization to be successful because it really facilitates communication in a way that nothing else does at this point. So
the yin and the yang of risk and value that we've talked about a lot here over the last couple of years, isn't it?
Mm. Right? Absolutely.
And then you can't get the value that you need. And then to your earlier point about legal holds, when one comes down, you've got to obviously keep everything. And a lot of organizations just tell the user on the desktop, well, now we're going to get here, Mike, is, okay, hold everything. And I think there are pretty high-profile cases where the users, you know, either inadvertently or on purpose deleted things, and that really creates big problems down the road.
Yeah. So in fact, that's a really good point. The general methodology we see this day, today, in terms of how you execute your preservation obligation, that hold obligation, is to send a note out, which is yet another email, if you will, to send an email out to all the people and says, anything to do with, in my old world it would have been Celebrex or Cox 2, anything to do with this drug or this product or this action that the organization is taking, you need to make sure you keep any document associated with it. That tends to really drive two behaviors, and neither of them are what we want. One, people panic and they just say, I got four of these in the last 3 months, and I have 12 of these, and you know what? I don't know what the heck I'm supposed to keep and what I'm not supposed to keep. I'm just going to make sure I never delete anything, and I'm going to put it all on my PST. Again, massive volume that drives up the cost of e-discovery later. The other behavior, of course, is that, well, I'm a little uncomfortable with some of the things that I have. I should just go ahead and delete it, which is obviously illegal and clearly the wrong behavior. Neither behavior that we really want to drive our organization or drive our individuals, users to.
This is Gary Murphy from Francis Group. I can stay a second. It seems to be the big problem. I mean, email, from my perspective, is kind of the least of your problems in the sense that it's essentially controlled exchange media, right? So I could establish a policy and put mechanisms in place to, you know, scan people's emails, have a central repository for store and forward that I could centrally control independent of what the end node employee is doing. It seems to me what's a much more difficult issue is, you know, you don't know a priori what a litigation is going to want to find in an e-discovery, so you can't be prescient enough to say, oh, what do I need to store or not store? And two, if I have a policy that I say, here's our corporate policy on storing stuff or retaining stuff, you know, how do you enforce that in non-centrally controlled mechanisms, right? I mean, databases I control, email to some extent I control. What I don't control is all that other unstructured stuff that's on individual people's desktops. You know, how is that? How do I centrally search that? How do I enforce the intent of a policy on all these things that aren't centrally controlled? Seems to me is a far more difficult task.
Yeah,
actually a perfect.
What a great segue, Jerry. Whoever that was.
That was Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry. Nice to hear you, Gary.
Hey, how you doing, Jerry?
I thank you for that. That is actually a perfect segue, isn't it, Michael? Because so what we wanted to do in the next section of this call is really talk about the fact that risk is essentially distributed, but you know, as a knee-jerk reaction, we've shoved everything into a centralized archive, and it's helped plug the hole, but it's not the long-term solution. So, Mike, can you talk about let's talk about the technologies that you've referenced that are coming, you know, to the fore to help us manage risk in a distributed fashion at the point where the content lives. And then we could talk a little bit about, you know, architectures that users can think about in the next, you know, coming years.
Absolutely. That, like I said, that was a great segue. I would like to kind of address the centralized email store briefly as well, because it ties into everything else. I think an important consideration that I probably should have said up front is that all legal records retention, your legal requirements, all of your rules and regulations, statutory obligations to keep stuff are predicated on the content of the information. It's never acceptable to say that, you know, because something's in an email, I'm going to delete all my email after a certain period of time. Because something's in a particular storage location, I'm just going to clean out that storage location after every 30 days because there are 3 years, because that's convenient and helps from an operational efficiency perspective. It's always content driven. So that's the big gap, because IT has so often been, I need to just, you know, I care about its age, or I care about how frequently it's accessed, because that lets you do hierarchical storage and better utilization of assets. That is not how legal ever looks at it. They look at it and say, if I wrote it on a napkin, if I wrote it in an email, if I have it on a document, it doesn't matter. The content of what I wrote is what drives the retention and preservation requirements of it. So the next step to segue from the content perspective is, in order to make a smart decision about how you're going to keep something and how long you're going to keep it, how long you're going to manage it, either centrally or decentrally, and again, the decentralized problem is probably the greater one, you have to be able to look at the content of information, and you have to be able to categorize it. It's that simple. You can't, frankly, any situation where we've asked end users to go ahead and try and categorize emails or documents or anything they create, have almost doomed, always doomed to failure, because of the reality is end users don't do a good job of categorization. Studies would show that they're inconsistent from one day to the next. They're certainly inconsistent across the group. So
and I think you might also agree, Mike, that leaving policies up to individuals rather than a central repository for managing policies is not a good idea.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
well, the thing is that end users haven't been able to find a delete key in the last 15 months, and I think that asking for classifying information, you're thinking about a whole different set of complexity.
Absolutely.
So this is Mark in too, by the way.
Yeah. So the complexity of classification is not trivial. I mean, but there are solutions out there that start to address this, and there have been some tools certainly that came out of the bioinformatics space and where they're, you know, text retrieval space, where we're starting to get much better at our ability to automatically classify information. There's tools such as support vector machines, probabilistic latent semantic indexing, decision trees, and other types of classification and categorization technologies that are pretty well proven and have been around for the last 10 or 15 years, have a pretty decent academic backing, and are used in a number of different settings. Those tools can be applied to large corpuses of text as well. And again, part of the one of the things around auto classification is that people often, are not sure where the bar in terms of accuracy is. I mean, when talking with my attorneys at Pfizer, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out where that was, and really where it came down to is that the bar needs to be, at least as good as humans, which isn't particularly high, by the way. It could be 60 or 70% accuracy. And it also, more importantly, or just as importantly, needs to be transparent and consistent. So it's never a process that can be gamed by an organization in order to try and get rid of stuff that could be problematic. It has to be completely transparent. It has to be auditable. So, and it has to be a process. So those kind of standards that are required for classification are met by, again, things like support vector machines and probabilistic latent semantic indexing. Both of those things are basically learning capabilities where you can feed a system a set of documents, and it can say, all right, hey, I'm gonna use this as my training set and go find others that are like that. So,
Mike, this is David Floyer.
Sure.
Can I just ask a question? You've said that as a statement. Has that been tested in court?
No, it has to some extent. We haven't had a court case that comes up and says, no, we didn't. We don't accept your classification. Frankly, in large part because people haven't really moved to it very quickly. We're just now starting to do it. We're starting to see some classification used for the review. So that attorney review piece I was talking about earlier, we're using some auto classification there. But certainly from a standards of evidence and admissibility. There's a very specific set of rulings that establish what would be admissible for, say, in expert testimony, and it's about things such as does it have a good academic background? Does it have a testing methodology to it? Is it well accepted? There's a set of questions associated with that, and the tools that we're talking about meet those requirements. And then the next step, of course, is as we start to utilize them, we'll find that they may get tested in court. But I think people are, again, talking to a number of attorneys, they're fairly comfortable that these tools can be proven to meet the requirements of legal defensibility. Again, it's also how you use it. It's ensuring that you're putting a process around it. It's not complete dependence on that tool either, or on that, support vector machines. It's putting a process around it that ensures it's auditable. Nothing's perfect. No technology is perfect. No one's ever held technology to that standard. But what they really are looking for is an auditability and a visibility and transparency and a process around it to ensure that it becomes defensible.
Mike, it's Mike Versace again. When you talk about the classification process, do you separate the declaration process from classification? So first, there's a process of inspecting content to declare content to be either an official record or not. Do you separate the two functions, and does technology support that?
That's an interesting question. A lot of people don't even realize that there is a declaration function in terms of a process for, say, records. My belief is no, that we shouldn't separate that. In fact, the tools that we build don't do that because they start at the beginning. This way they can understand what it is at its inception and then at that point make decisions about how it should be managed because it may never need to be declared. And in fact, idea is you want to identify all the stuff that's crap, all this junk that sits out there. You don't want to declare it. You just want to be able to move it off and get rid of it.
So identifying the information that might have a statutory or regulatory obligation through a declaration process is, when it is a first step, but shortly followed or in tandem, the classification scheme relative to retention and criticality and security and those types of attributes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? There's, again, there's other things. We're talking about retention, but there's certainly data loss prevention questions as well. There's confidentiality issues, HIPAA. There's a whole set of issues that are beyond just that single the single thing about whether it's a record or not. And in fact, many organizations are finding, one of the things that I saw was that we had a group of people looking at data security and data loss prevention, another group of folks looking at data privacy, another group of people looking at records. Again, all content-based decisions on how an organization is going to manage a particular document based upon effectively what's in it. Well, that and they're coming at it with different perspectives. But they're putting demands onto the business, say, all right, this is confidential, or this, and you can't do this. So we have all these demands that various groups are putting onto the business, which aren't centralized and aren't well coordinated. So again, the net of it is a burden to the business, and ultimately in the interest of risk mitigation.
Mike, can you take us through? You've referenced a number of different tools, and you've sort of vaguely referenced some of the stuff that you guys do. Can you talk more specifically about the tools that Rational Retention provides and just share with us sort of where you're headed? You're an innovative new startup. We like to hear from, you know, CTO-like folks like yourself, even though you're not the CTO, but just give us a glimpse of what you're doing and specifically what tools are really, you know, real that users can think about applying here over the next several months or years.
So specifically, we've actually before I get too deep, I'd like to talk a little bit about that distributed control component, because actually Rational Retention is all about executing that distributed control. We got a little bit off onto the auto classification, which is central to the problem. But then once it's classified, you still need to figure out what you're going to do with it. So I've still got this document sitting on my desktop. What can I do with it? And really, you need to be able to do a couple of things. With that document, you need to be able to uniquely identify. You need to be able to use something like a hash, SHA-1, or MD5, or combination. And there, again, lots of technology out there that uniquely identifies that. You then need to really make the content of that visible. And by making the content of it visible, you've seen tools as enterprise search tools or the number of tools that let you extract the text of that document. You can extract the text and the metadata from that document, and you can use that information to then make decisions, then to classify it, and then make policy-based decisions on how to manage it according to that classification. So it importantly is you need to be uniquely identify and then make it visible. And then beyond that, you need to have tools that allow you to prevent the delete in place. So again, instance of electronic discovery where you've got a preservation requirement, you need to be able to proactively prevent that delete from happening. You basically prevent the user from doing something that they're not supposed to do. You also need to be able to move or copy that stuff, because when you think about it, the next part from an e-discovery perspective is certainly that you want to go ahead and collect that document, because ultimately you have to produce it to the other side. Well, after you've identified it, you prevented that destruction of it, then you go collect it and move it forward. Then really the last thing is the ability to enforce a delete. You need to be able to say centrally, like, you know, this type of document shouldn't be around, and we should get rid of it because it's reached the end of its life. So at that point, you want to be able to centrally enforce that delete. So effectively what you're doing is centralized control using the text and metadata of a document from a central repository, but executing to distributed action. So it's centralized control of a distributed environment. Rational Retention specifically does exactly that. So I'm talking about a tool that we have that allows us to, by using agents, to sit on a desktop or to integrate with an email server that explicitly do all of the things I just described and allow you to extract that text and metadata and to ultimately push things to exert control on documents as they exist in place. So it's an in-place control. So that obviates the need for much of the email archiving or file archiving that's necessary. Now, there is an archiving component, because you don't want to – that's why I said move as well, is you don't want to keep documents that say you don't want to keep a record on a desktop. Desktops aren't that – you know, they're pretty ephemeral. They don't last that long. And it's certainly not the right place to keep it. It may start there, but eventually it ought to get moved to someplace else. So there is a need for archiving. There is a need for retaining things centrally. So absolutely that doesn't go away. But the idea is, through classification, is to reduce dramatically the amount of stuff that has to go into that central archive, and only the things that go into that central archive are things that the organization needs to keep for a period that would be longer than you could reliably manage it in its active state. Again, things like email, where you don't want to fill up the repository too much, things like the desktop, where it's just not stable enough that you want to keep it around, things like even document management systems, where you might want to move those to a centralized records repository that has more robust records retention to it. Again, these are things that Rational Retention does.
So you've just sort of, I think, announced, I don't know, late last year or early this year. What kind of feedback are you getting? I mean, can you talk about, you know, some of the issues you're seeing, whether it's around agent, you know, base systems, or you know, the interference with the technology operations? What kind of things are customers telling you? And what can users expect there?
Yeah. Well, the good news is the feedback's really good. In general, people see this as a great opportunity and a great method to go ahead and gain control of a set of data, a set of information out there that just feels completely out of control to them, and they know that it's causing risk. So there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt because of it. So we can come in and establish that control, and people see that very positively. Obviously, putting something out on the desktop that's akin to a virus scanner, you know, the IT people have a rightfully so, are concerned about that. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to see anything that's going to interrupt their or damage the stability of it, of the desktop environment. They want to keep that as clean and robust as possible. Certainly, integrating with the email environment, people are very concerned about email. It's a highly transactional environment, and and servers are optimized for certain things. So how you integrate with that as well in a way that's lightweight and handles just a few actions, but doesn't doesn't interfere with the email environment. From a policy perspective, some of the challenges are saying, well, I understand this, and I think this is the right way to do it, but we don't have our act together enough to establish our policies. That's probably, you know, the technical side can mostly be addressed, as long as you're smart about it from a testing perspective and ensure that use your IT skills and use them appropriately. The policy side does take some time. People need to understand what the policies are. They need to be able to organize them in a way that's simple and ultimately codifiable, and then again, do things like build training sets or queries that can go ahead and uniquely identify them. So those are the biggest things that we're seeing. But in general, when we talk particularly to the legal folks, and then we talk to the legal folks and the IT folks together, which is always how we want to frame it, we get a very positive response. And I'm open to asking, you know, questions, obviously, about that as well.
Yeah, anybody want to, you know, challenge what Mike said in the last 5 minutes, or ask any specific questions before we sort of talk about how to architect something like this and then the ROI? Any other comments, criticisms?
This is David Flyer again. Mike, I'd like to gently challenge the idea that one solution is going to be suitable for all industries, and maybe a sub question underneath that is what industries should be looking at this as a priority, or you know, where are the risks of holding things more relevant? But given that that's one of your key benefits that you have been talking about.
So I think the first question. Sorry about, I don't know why someone's phone here. The first question is, how applicable is it for different organizations? It's about how you develop the policies in a way where the policies can be built and applied to the particular needs of that industry. Different industries are going to have different policies. They're going to have different risk tolerances. They're going to have different issues associated with different with retention and with data loss prevention and whatnot. But if you think about some of the solutions, again, such as auto categorization, these things are effectively language independent, so they're industry independent as well, because you're using statistical and mathematical models to go ahead and identify documents. So that really helps us get out of something that is too industry specific. Certainly who are the industries that are most interested in these things? Any large organization that is getting litigated, and frankly, that's any large organization. has a strong desire and interest in this. The financial industry, the pharmaceutical industries, any healthcare industries, they certainly are very, very interested because of the types of litigation they get involved in and the challenges. And frankly, that we're seeing more and more even medium-sized companies being interested because of the regulatory oversight that they incur. Even if they're not constantly litigated, the amount of regulatory oversight, think to a hospital, for instance, their accreditation and audit process is really kind of onerous. And tools that allow them to get their data, to find their data and produce it in a way that can be effective and to be quick, really help them quite a bit. So, again, highly regulated, even if you're not litigated. And then obviously all the folks involved in the serial litigants out there.
Mike, just one quick follow-up. Do you see these tools being used sort of proactively? So from the point of content creation?
Yeah.
Or reactively?
That's a great question.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, so that's exactly how we think about it. Those are the terms we use. We use the proactive side. The proactive side is all about enforcing your policies. Ultimately, it's ensuring that you're getting rid of the stuff you need to get rid of and keeping the stuff you need to keep. On the reactive side, you can leverage the same set of capabilities because you know where. Again, we've got a distributed and control of that distributed environment. We know where it is. As long as you have the capability to prevent deletes, which is that the first reactive thing you've got to do, and you have the ability to collect the information, at that point, you've got an ability to perform, to have an appropriate litigation or investigation response. So it really works on both sides. And a good thing is that you end up investing, instead of spending money time and time on litigation, if you can start to drive down the cost of those litigations by putting in tools that can control the documents that you have in a proactive way, you start to really, you're not so much just throwing your money away because you've got a litigation, you're investing in a more capable infrastructure for the future.
Thanks.
Okay. So, Mike, you've talked about some of the tools and technology. So I want to ask you to sort of put yourself in the shoes of a lot of folks out there. So they've plugged the holes. They've spent millions and maybe even tens of millions on email archiving system. It's journaling everything and doing the e-discovery. So now you're faced with the challenge of architecting sort of the next generation. You even said earlier that, you sort of went into this knowing that, it was a short-term solution. Are we at a point where we're looking at next generation where we can actually implement it today, or maybe not even so much worried about today's implementation, but help us think through the architecture. So you've talked about this metadata repository and this agent-based system addressing risk in a decentralized fashion. Can you just paint a picture of the architecture that you might put forth if you were in the position of a lot of users?
Absolutely. So the architecture in the simplest way, and I think, Dave, you just described it, is a centralized metadata repository. And that metadata repository has information, your typical metadata that you have from a file, but it also has the text of a file, and you're going to use that for control. The idea is you need to pull as much information into that metadata repository as possible. So there is some level of centralization. I don't think we can, move to a complete decentralized point where you're actually pushing the entire policy out to various applications, because the overhead of changing the applications or changing the operating systems is really just too much. Eventually, what we want to see is, and this moves, I think you can go beyond. I mean, by the way, our solution, just to, not to correct you, but we do think our solution is the longer-term direction. The near-term, the reactive solution is that massive central archive. We think the longer-term solution is control of the documents and control of the files, in place where they reside, and then only archiving those things that really need to be archived for a particular purpose. And I think that's a long-term approach. You need to move, again, the capabilities out, and you need to move, again, that capability to preserve it, to hold it, the capability to proactively collect it, that capability to proactively delete it, into the distributed environment. So you're going to need to see, I think, a more robust set of APIs so that you can send information out and extract information and ensure that you can control that distributed environment. And that distributed environment is going to keep moving. When you think it's going to be my BlackBerry, it's going to be instant messaging, it's going to be whatever next generation devices, it's certainly going to be more in terms of document management systems and collaboration tools and wikis and blogs and websites and all those things that create content that the organization needs to have some control. But as long as by any application or operating system that creates that type of content or manages that type of content, as long as you have a mechanism to basically make that content visible and uniquely identifiable, to make that content to be able to tell that system that you shall not allow the deletion of that content for any particular period of time, and then to tell the system that can you give me the whole content because I need it for a particular purpose, and then tell the application now it's time to delete that or move that. As long as you can do those four things to any distributed environment, if you have a centralized policy engine and a centralized categorization engine, you can affect control on it to a point that allows you to meet your compliance obligations today and ultimately tomorrow.
So one of the problems you're having there is basically the crawling off the network to maybe find content, which in some organizations could literally bring down the entire network down to its knees because it's not capable of handling these kind of requests. How are you going to solve that?
Yeah,
that's one of the biggest drawbacks of having a distributed environment is that you cannot find the information in time because the networks are not suitable, and not everywhere in the world everybody has a T1 line. How are you dealing with remote offices that just have a satellite link? You cannot scan that entire network because you don't have the bandwidth, and that bandwidth is shared with other mission-critical systems.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. It depends on how you tackle the bandwidth. So first of all, you're not in the architecture that I'm putting forth, you're not necessarily sending the entirety of a file over. Again, you're sending something that probably represents 8, 10, 12% at best over the line. So it's not so huge. So in an active state, it's pretty easy because, again, you're doing more of you've got agents out there that sit on the desktop. Once they're sitting there, they're doing the work and doing the extraction. So you are distributing some of the processing. So effectively, you're like a distributed file system. You're distributing that processing out as far as you can go to the endpoint, and you're leveraging some of the processing power that exists on all the various endpoint devices. So that certainly helps you. You do have a communications component that requires you to send commands, which is pretty trivial, but also to send to extract some of that information back, and that does have some bandwidth implications on it. I mean, there's no way around it. Frankly, it's not particularly heavyweight, but you need to make sure that you do have the network infrastructure so you can do it. Also, one of the things that's important though is that any activity associated with a distributed environment has to be asynchronous. So there's no way that you can force it to be asynchronous. There's just too much communication to create too much chatter on the network. So it has to be such that there's a queuing mechanism on the distributed device, and that's what we've done certainly for email, for SharePoint, for desktops and things like that, where you have some mechanism to queue things up and manage that distributed environment so that you're only and that you can also work in a throttling mechanism, so you can work either offline or at a time when you're not utilizing network bandwidth is at its most available.
Personally, I'm still a fan, though, as I heard PST files brought up, the smart intuitive, by the way. I cannot see any legitimate reason at all other than handing information over to an opposing counsel to have PST files in any corporate environment. It's great for home use, but there's no real good reason to have PST files because there are adequate centralized options available. The only reasons why you have PST files that generally it's being used is for storage problems, and that can be solved with just providing adequate storage on the servers. The problem with you, there's multiple problems with you having is PC files. One, it's completely out of control. There is no way to know where that information is stored other than crawling the physical drive. PC files are used for people walking out of the door with all the corporate IT and walking to the competitor. They can store the information on a thumb drive. You can't search a PC file when it's not really easily mounted. You have to. It's really the whole problem. But once you have PC files in your environment, it's something you really should eradicate. So even, you know, bring it up as, you know, end users can have PST files to, you know, classify information, or if they want to store PSTs, you know, for or use them for personal data, absolutely, it should be absolutely banned in any corporate environment because you don't know what's in it.
How has I'm not sure who was speaking. You know, there are many people who would agree with you, and that, but I think you run into the basic conflict of what the business needs in order to do their work, and the kind of, I mean, when you think about it, you think of the kind of commoditization, and you see people understand and know and use their PC at home. The reality is. You know, making all terminals effectively dumb or web based hasn't really got the traction that you would have that we think. Some companies are able to do it, and but they do it with some loss of productivity by doing that. So you need to be able to balance that as to whether you're willing to take that productivity hit and insert that level of control. Again, our tool basically allows you to have that control without having to take the productivity hit, and there are other people who like to do the same thing. But you're right. I mean, you could make the strong centralized argument is I don't want to keep anything on my PC at all. But the fact is, I'd be curious as to what the people on the call think, but how realistic that is if they went and told the users that was going to be the case.
What about that, folks?
Can we just...
So this is Jerry Murphy. One of the things that might make that problem a little better from a security and compliance standpoint is the virtualization of PCs. I'm definitely seeing, I think with the economy where it is, you're seeing a delay in adoption, but certainly from a security perspective as well as compliance perspective and manageability, there is this concept of having a, you know, basically a blade PC, or you got, you know, PCs, blade servers in the central organization, and all you've got at the end user is essentially a dumb terminal, in which case I now, as a central department, have much tighter control over what somebody's actually doing on their, you know, the end unit becomes a virtual end unit that is, in fact, centrally controlled. So I think people who have special concerns about compliance and security issues will probably start adopting that model to increase the control of that.
And that's, we have seen that in some cases. But we haven't seen it terribly, terribly widespread. And it's, we look at government agencies in the Beltway area. I mean, we're seeing some of that. Some of the most security sensitive companies out there are taking that. But again, they do so, with a set of issues around productivity and ability for people to work.
Yeah, I was going to say I can't see all those traders on Wall Street handing in their BlackBerries.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's not the problem with the BlackBerries. It's really the problem with the PST files that I'm mostly concerned about. So this is Martin Tudor, by the way, speaking. And the problem what you're having is once it's out down there, even finding, especially in a large distributed environment, there's one organization that I know has over 200 terabyte of PST file data. And if you have a request, you know, if you get an e-discovery request coming in, you have to comply with providing an information back in X time. There's no way on earth you can comply with finding and crawling through 200 terabytes of information within the set limits. And we're talking in not only that's a very extreme case, the loss of productivity is a moot point when you can have a 1 gigabyte mailbox basically for the same TCO as a 20 meg mailbox. Drives are cheap these days. Microsoft recommends simple SATA drives. It's not the cost of the storage and exchange that says, well, you need PC files. That was really important back in 2000. The whole messaging environment has moved on since then. That there is no reason to have a PC file, not even for productivity uses, because you can give someone a gig mailbox. In fact, you can get one for free at Gmail.
What kind of adoption do you see of that model out there in the industry?
Having very restricted mailboxes is going to be very problematic doing
yes,
that.
Yes.
What's not going to happen is not just PST files. People are going to forward emails onto Gmail because they're going to say, hey, I don't want to have it on a PST file because if I'm at home, that PST file is on my computer. I cannot access that data when I'm at home. So they're going to forward it to Hotmail. They're going to forward it to Gmail. And that problem, that email data is out of your control because it's a third party where you do not have, with any kind of tool in the world, permission or any kind of management or records management over that data because it's in another system, somewhere in another country possibly. What are you going to do at that point?
But that information can be subpoenaed and can be pulled into an electronic discovery situation.
Correct, but you, at that point you have to first interview everybody first. Do you have information that you forwarded to your home? At that point, that whole cost of e-discovery skyrockets out of control.
Yeah,
instead of just saying, hey, end users, everything is in the centralized archive, we'll prevent it from being certain data from being forwarded, or we don't create the PhD files. You're just going to save yourself a whole lot of trouble and cost as well.
Yeah, and you're clearly seeing organizations today, you know, the big brother syndrome of actually warning employees about forwarding PCs or forwarding emails to home PCs or other, you know, Gmail accounts and sitting down and interviewing them after they've done it, you know, and trying to identify what the problem is. And that clearly adds
the cost. And so, can I speak? That's an interesting point. I mean, I'm not sure what the exact number is right now of desktops versus laptops out there in terms of what was sold recently. I know in Europe over 50% of the new PCs sold were laptops. So we have a really, really mobile workforce out there, and they do have very specific expectations of what they can and can't do on their desktops. So to necessarily throttle those expectations and prevent them to say work on, or you know they can only, for instance, they can't save anything onto their desktop. They have to be online. While it's getting closer, we're certainly a ways away from that. And I think just from a learning curve for users and a overall usability and comfort level, I don't think we're going to see a situation very, very quickly where all storage is centralized. That said, even if you do start to centralize the storage, you still have the same problem in terms of content extraction, understanding the storage by its content, segmenting that content out, and then getting rid of it at some mechanism or not. Whether you treat the storage sitting on the desktop centrally or decentralized, it doesn't change the problem. It changes where you have to put the solution. But the problem remains the same.
Do you have a sense, Mike, relative to the discussion on desktop content, how big of when you think of the whole picture of the all of the content out there, this the challenge of declaration and classification and segmentation that you were talking about, how much of that content is desktop-based content? Do you have any averages for that? And
you know, it's interesting. E-discovery, we always collected hundreds or thousands of custodians, and we used to have some pretty comprehensive numbers on it. The fact is it changes pretty dramatically from organization to organization.
Okay.
And here's another piece, it's an important consideration, and I think everybody here understands it, is that the reality is content starts on the desktop, it gets emailed out. You create a file, I do some work on that file and send it out to another four or five people. When it's all said and done, if you've got an email archive and a few other things, you may have that single file may exist in 25 places. And you think about it, you can start, and it's in my OST, it's in maybe a PST, it's in the email, it's in on my desktop. So that same thing is widely, widely scattered across the organization. And again, that drives a huge amount of storage waste and certainly costs on e-discovery because of the need to deduplicate that.
Sorry to cut you off. We have to wrap here. We didn't have time to get into the ROI, but just real quickly, I'm hearing, you know, cost, essentially, you got to put in a new architecture, and you're not really going to be able to, you know, totally leverage what you have installed, and then potentially some network cost to address the potential problem, the bandwidth issue that Martin was talking about, although it feels like you're sort of pushing around bandwidth, so I'm not sure that's going to be, that may be a net neutral. And then the benefits, reclaiming wasted storage space clearly is one, and it feels like it's less expensive than first-generation architectures, maybe not as heavy and perhaps even less disruptive to the business, but I'm not sure of that. Is that
our position is the records management tools in general and a lot of these tools in general had crummy acceptance because they interfere with the way people work. And even the idea of centralizing everything and not letting anybody save anything on the PC or whatever, again, it makes sense. But the fact is, the more we can, the less disruptive we can be to the end user, the better IT is serving its ultimate purpose, which is make people protect, you know, product productive. I mean, that's what IT is all about. security is a byproduct, but ultimately our goal here is to increase productivity. So any solution that our view is that by putting a distributed control, centralized control over a distributed environment, if you will, and doing it in a way that doesn't interfere with the end users, is that you get the best of both worlds. You get the risk reduction, you get the cost reduction, but you don't get the fundamental pushback from the end users, and ultimately the business go ahead and do what they need to do, and they can do the job of, you know, manufacturing or, you know, making drugs or you know, or finance, whatever it may be. But
making money, yeah.
Yeah, they're making money, which is what they're there for.
All right, excellent. So I think we had a really good session today. We laid out the problem statement, I think, pretty well, and we started to really scratch at the technologies and the architecture that could address this, you know, with a major emphasis on managing risk in a distributed fashion. And I want to thank Michael McCreary of Rational Retention for leading the call today, and also really appreciate the contributions. Mike Versace, Gary McFadden, Dave Berman, Jerry Murphy, Martin Tuip, and David Floyer, thank you very much for your questions and comments. We have, on February 24th, Daryl Molitor of JCPenney is going to be participating in a panel along with Phil Bullinger of LSI, Claude Barrera of IBM, and Ken Osterberg of Seagate, talking about driving data center efficiencies using both, you know, green IT as a theme, as well as solid state disk and flash. And then on March 17th, we have a peer insight with the folks from Cal State U East Bay. Rich Avila, the director of network operations, is going to talk about a case study of how they implemented virtualization to avert an energy crisis. So look for those. We will also be posting up on Wikibon in the next 24 hours our summary of this meeting, as well as implications for users. So please look for that. And we'll also be doing an audio mashup and a podcast of this call. So we'll send that out to you as well, and that'll be up on the site. So thanks very much, everybody. Appreciate your time today, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Thanks, Dave.